from Microsoft, who's getting set up here.
Excuse me.
And he is going to tell you about a kind of attack called a snowball attack that you probably didn't realize that you are at risk of, but since coming to Montana, I'm sure you are all well aware of the risks of runaway snowballs. So he's going to describe a system dealing with basically information that gets leaked from machine to machine and in that snowballs and becomes worse for you. So with that, John.
Thanks, Stefan. So my name is John Dunnigan. It's my great pleasure to speak to you today about HeatRay, a system for combating identity snowball attacks using machine learning, combinatorial optimization, and attack graphs. This is joint work with Alice Zhang, who's also in the audience, and Dan Simon, both at Microsoft with me. I have a really simple outline. I'm going to tell you about the problem, in particular defining an identity snowball attack and measuring the potential of that attack in a large organization. Then I'm going to tell you about our proposed solution, HeatRay, and in particular, how HeatRay scales to the amount of configuration in a large organization. Then going to go through evaluation, related work, and finally conclude. The basic problem that we're dealing with in this paper is how an initial compromise can lead to additional compromises. I'm going to illustrate that with the following security configuration. There's a machine called Alice Desktop, and the account Alice logs into that machine. That account Alice also has administrative privileges on another machine called Alice Laptop. Now, when an attacker enters the world and compromises Alice Desktop in some way, perhaps through a social engineering exploit or through some other mechanism, because the account Alice has logged into Alice Desktop, the account Alice has trusted that machine to perform actions on her behalf throughout the network. We're going to represent that as the account now being compromised because the adversary can perform any of those actions him or herself. And in particular, because the account Alice has administrative privileges on the machine Alice Laptop, that account is really entitled to do things like arbitrarily modify the operating system there and perhaps install a rootkit. So we're now going to represent that machine as being compromised. Now, all of this in the context that we studied it in is done, all this authentication system is done using Kerberos. And so the exact mechanics under the covers of how the adversary can impersonate Alice is that Alice's Kerberos ticket granting ticket is physically present on Alice's desktop. But I don't want you to think of this as being a Kerberos-specific issue. Many modern identity systems try to allow your machine to perform actions on your behalf once you've given it some secret, such as a password. Now I'm going to continue on with extending this security configuration example to have Alice also being a member of a security group, HeatRay Project, that has administrative privileges on another machine, HeatRay Test PC. Well, not surprisingly, the adversary can compromise those as well, and if somebody else, like me, logs into HeatRay Test PC, my account gets compromised as well. So, we're not going to be focusing on preventing this initial compromise in this talk. There's been a lot of great work in the research community on how to do that. We're really going to be focusing on how to prevent the spread of compromise to other machines. And this is what we're going to refer to as an identity snowball attack. It's using the compromised identities to launch yet more compromises in this network. The reason that we call it a snowball attack is because of the snowball effect of how these additional compromises make further compromises easier. The adversary gets a machine, can get a number of accounts from it. If those accounts have administrative privileges on a number of other machines, they get a lot more machines. And this is illustrated by the growing and scary-looking snowball in the lower right-hand corner of this slide. So that's the source of the name. So some public attacks in the past have iteratively used compromised identities. For example, the Morse worm from 1988, back when the internet was tiny. Most worms recently have not used compromised identities. They've only relied on a buffer overflow exploit or something like that. There was also an attack reported by Singer in 2004. There was a cross-organization attack on academic and government sites, and which was not fully automated. So, as far as we're aware of, there hasn't been any previous analysis on the threat of this kind of attack within a single large organization. And the reason large organizations are interesting for a number of reasons, one of which is that a lot of the computing in the world is done within the context of large organizations. A second reason is that large organizations, the threat of identity snowball attacks within large organizations forces us to ask whether a large number of what may be locally reasonable configuration choices, such as a particular account having administrative privileges on a particular machine, add up in aggregate to a globally reasonable outcome, to a global outcome that we're happy with. So, To figure that out, we decided to do some measurements. We took one organization with about 100,000 accounts and 200,000 machines, and over the course of 1 week, we measured all of the errors that are present in this example that I've been using throughout the talk thus far. In particular, where accounts and groups have administrative privileges, what accounts belong to what group, and who logs in where. Now, just having all of this data isn't quite enough for understanding the threat of identity snowball attacks. There are also two modeling issues that we have to deal with, and I want to tell you explicitly what it is that how we decided to deal with them. One is the attacker's window of opportunity after login. And here the issue is that if an account logs in and then immediately logs out, and then the adversary compromises the machine, the adversary has not compromised that account. So at this stage in our work, because we wanted to understand whether even under a defender optimistic assumption, the identity snowball attacks still pose a threat based on our data. And so we decided here to model accounts as immediately logging out, which is quite optimistic for the defender, really minimizes the attacker's window of opportunity. The other modeling issue we have to deal with is how fast an attacker can compromise nodes where they now have administrative privileges. Remember, it's by design that now the attacker can arbitrarily modify the operating system on these nodes. And installing a rootkit really takes on the order of seconds. So because the other change in our system, such as giving somebody administrative privileges on a machine or removing them, tend to happen on a much slower time scale, we modeled this as being immediate. Now, combining that data and the modeling and the way we dealt with those two modeling issues, we found that there was significant reason for concern. I'm now going to tell you about this graph. To construct this graph, we did 100 trials, where in each trial, we picked one random machine and modeled it being initially compromised, and then using this attack vector in order to compromise a number of other machines. And what we found was that the median over all those trials of the number of machines that had been compromised over just one day was over 700. This is very bad. This corresponds to perhaps a very large number of people having all of their work destroyed, or who could potentially have all of their work destroyed, or an equivalent number of people having all of the secret organization-specific documents that they have being sent out to the public at large or to a competitor. And so we would have liked to have looked at more organizations, but the data that we've collected in order to do this analysis is literally a map for how to quickly compromise machines in the organization. And so right now, all of our measurements are only based on this one organization. However, given this reason for concern, I now want to summarize what it is that we said about the problem. It's that identity snowball attacks are scary because they magnify the impact of an initial compromise. And with 200,000 machines, it's not realistic to assume that there are zero such initial compromises. They've been used in the past in other contexts, and our measurements thus far have suggested that they pose a significant risk of harm in the context of large organizations. So how are we going to tackle this problem? Well, one of the first things that we decided was that understanding the cumulative impact of all of these individual trust decisions really required an algorithmic approach. This was also the motivation for a lot of prior work on attack graphs. However, when we looked at that prior work, we found that it often focused on only defending a small set of high-value machines, such as protecting an email server or protecting some single file server within an organization. It also often relied on manual examination of many possible changes. And one of the differences in a large organization context is that we really need to scale up to the amount of configuration in this organization, which is millions of possible security configuration changes. And a lot of them, you really don't want to be told about if you're the IT administrator. A lot of them are low impact, and that even if you go through the effort of making the change, you haven't really reduced the rate of spread of an identity snowball attack. And the other problem is a lot of them are simply not implementable. So for example, if there's somebody who has administrative privileges on a machine because they're the ones responsible for patching it so that there's not an exploitable buffer overflow on that machine, they need to keep those administrative privileges. And so we only want to find the security configuration changes that actually are implementable and won't interfere with other people's workflow in this organization. That then leads us to our proposed solution, which deals with those two problems of I have a large number of changes and I want to find the high impact changes in them. That's going to be the box on the left. And I want those changes to be implementable, and that's the box on the right. And for the next section of this talk, I'm going to get into the details of how it is that we accomplished those two goals, how those two boxes work. The overall loop is that the current security configuration comes into the box that looks for high impact changes, and that box then proposes them to the IT administrator, who can label these security configuration changes as changes that they are willing to accept or changes that they reject. The HeatWave will then take that feedback from the IT administrator, try and learn a better model of what it is that this particular IT administrator considers to be an implementable change and do a better job of proposing in future rounds changes that are both high impact and that the IT administrator is willing to implement. We then just repeat the loop until we're happy with where we've gotten to in terms of having reduced the risk of this kind of attack. So now, diving into that first box about how it is that we propose high impact changes, the first step we're going to do is to make the problem suitable for algorithmic analysis using the formalism of an attack graph. In particular, every node in the graph is going to be an asset that we want to protect, such as an account or a machine. And every edge in the graph is going to be something that gives control from one asset to another asset. So, for example, the administrator, an account having administrative privileges on a machine gives that account control over the machine. And if you look at the pictures I've been drawing thus far, I've been describing them as boxes and arrows, but you could equivalently interpret them as nodes and edges. A security configuration change, then, in the real world, maps into removing an edge in this graph. An example would be removing Alice's administrative privileges on Alice's laptop. That corresponds to removing one of those edges from the running example, right? The one that points from Alice's account to Alice's laptop machine. Given this formalism, I now want to define what is the metric that we're trying to optimize for when it is that we identify a change as being high impact. Well, intuitively, a set of changes is high impact if it's a small number of changes that prevents many compromised nodes from threatening many other nodes. In graph terms, that's just a small set of edges that, when removed, they separate a large set of nodes from another large set of nodes. And that's exactly the mathematical problem of sparsest cut. Now, sparsest cut, in case you're, you don't remember this from your algorithms class, it's a lot. It's very similar to mid-cut, but it balances there being a small number of edges in the cut with there being a large number of separated nodes. And that's illustrated below. The min cut in this graph that I've drawn below only removes one edge, but it only separates one node from a very large other number of nodes. Whereas the sparse cut has to remove more edges, but it separates one large set of nodes from another large set of nodes. And then in the paper, in order to solve the combinatorial optimization problem that we now have, we just modified an existing sparsest cut algorithm to run faster, and that was by relaxing its approximation guarantee in a way that was appropriate for our context. Now that we've been able to analyze all of these changes and figure out which are the ones that are high impact, we want to do, we take one more step to further reduce the burden on the IT administrator, and that's to group related edges. In particular, what I mean by grouping related edge is that if they have a common start or destination node, we propose them as a single edge group change to the administrator. This is illustrated in the bottom, in the picture on the bottom of the slide, where a particular security group, heat rate project, has administrative privileges on two separate machines. If both of these were things that we were going to propose to the IT administrator, we would propose them as remove heat rate project security group from having administrative privileges on every machine. That means the IT administrator then just has one choice, and if they want to make that global choice, they've removed multiple edges at a time. We're now at the point where heat rate has proposed all the changes to the IT administrator. The IT administrator goes through and labels them as accept or reject. I'm now going to get into how it is that we learn from what the IT administrator has been willing to accept in order to do a better job of proposing implementable changes in the next iteration. So, remember, the problem here is that there are just too many edges to label them all manually as whether or not you're willing to act on that security configuration change. So instead, we're going to use machine learning to generalize from the small number of labels that have already been provided by the IT administrator based on the output of that first step, and use that in order to understand what kinds of changes are acceptable. In particular, changes that the IT administrator accepted, those are going to correspond to relatively cheap edges to cut in the graph, and changes that the IT administrator rejected are going to correspond to expensive edges to cut. And we then need to understand or estimate for every unknown edge whether it's more like the known cheap or known expensive edges. The way we're going to do this is by modeling the cost of every unknown edge is a function of other known attributes of that edge. In particular, we're going to model it as an unknown linear function over the known in and out degrees in the attack graph of the start and destination nodes of the edge that we're considering for removal. We're going to combine this with the output that we got from the sparsest cut algorithm that told us the benefit of removing that edge. So now I have the benefit, I have a mathematical formalism for the cost involving unknowns. And what I'm going to do with every single label that the IT administrator gave me is translate it into a constraint that relates those knowns and unknowns. And the way I'm going to do that is that when the IT administrator told us that they accepted a configuration change, we're going to translate that into a constraint that the benefit of cutting that edge was greater than the cost of cutting that edge. Intuitively, because they wanted to do it. And every time they rejected a configuration change, we're going to translate it into a constraint that the benefit was less than the cost. Then, once we have this family of constraints, and with knowns on one side, unknowns on the other, we just apply the support vector machine approach in order to find the best cost model to fit these constraints. We've now learned a cost model. We can apply it to all the unknown edge costs in the entire graph and feed that back into sparsest cut with now new edge costs that reflect whether or not these changes are being estimated to be implementable by our methodology. And sparsest cut then is going to automatically balance finding high impact edges with implementable edges. I'm now going to move on to the evaluation. The main evaluation that we did of the effectiveness of this approach was to do 10 iterations through the heap grade loop, examining 900 changes on each iteration, accepting some of them, rejecting others, and then seeing where we had gotten to at the end of all of these iterations. So the way that we evaluated where we were before, at the beginning, before running any heap grade, which was the blue line on the left of the graph, and also where we got to at the end, which is the green line on the right of the graph, is that we did 1,000 trials where on each trial, we modeled the impact of a random initial compromise and how quickly it could spread throughout this graph. Now, for the purpose of assessing the effectiveness of our security technology, we stopped making the defender optimistic assumption of immediate logout that I mentioned earlier in the talk. And instead, we switched to an assumption that people don't log out. Because in fact, we don't want to have the security of the system be conditioned on getting lucky with people logging out quickly after they've logged in, right? That didn't seem like a good, robust assumption. And here's what we found. What we found was that under this new assumption of not having immediate logout, 98% of the machines that you could have initially compromised randomly in the beginning would have led to being able to reach over 1,000 other machines through this attack, through basically the web of security configuration that existed in the status quo. After going through these 9,000 changes, we were down to less than 4% of the machines that could be initially randomly compromised, then being able to have an identity snowball attack that reached over 1,000 other machines. So going through 9,000 security configuration changes may seem like a lot of work. This is one of the comments we got in some of our reviews, and I agree, it is a lot of work. It is far better than the initial 4.5 million possible configuration changes that the IT administrator otherwise is stuck looking at. So all of the work that we did here was done in coordination with the IT group in the study of the organization. And in fact, the model that we applied in our evaluation for whether to accept or reject a configuration change was developed in coordination with this IT group, and it's explained in the paper in some detail. Also, before we submitted this paper, we helped the IT group identify and implement security configuration changes that did reduce the identity snowball threat. There's a fair amount of additional evaluation in the paper, in particular a comparison of heap rate to alternatives, such as simple heuristics for identifying configuration changes. There was also more detailed analysis of how our support vector machine methodology performed, its misclassification rate, and how exactly the learned model over node degrees captured the IT administrator's preferences over the kinds of security configuration changes that they were willing to implement. Then there's also more detailed analysis of the changes that were identified by heap rate along the way. Turning now to related work, I've already described to you the basic comparison to prior research using attack graphs. And the main difference is that heap rate addresses new scalability challenges that come from looking at this threat in this context. There's also been a lot of prior work on authorization that's focused on new mechanisms. There's been work on decentralized mechanisms, like in the secure file system work or the Sudsy Smicky work. There's been a lot of work on fine-grained delegation. One of the pieces of work that I'm most familiar with is in the context of singularity, where a simplified version of this is that authorization decisions could be made, for example, both based on the user who is running an application and on the identity of the application. There's also been a lot of work on information flow control. I listed a few systems there. And compared to almost all of this prior work, the main difference is that heap rate focuses on identifying the right policy for an existing mechanism. It's not a new mechanism. And since we're at the symposium on operating systems principles, I want to leave you with a principle. The principle that I advocate is that managing security configuration requires system support. In particular, if you don't have system support, it's hard to know how bad your current security configuration is. Even once you know how bad it is, it's really helpful to have system support in order to most effectively fix your security configuration. Thank you. Go ahead.
That's easier said than done. Intel Research. So one thing that I'd like to ask you about is, you're taking a very interesting and cool quantitative approach to trying to figure out those configuration changes. Can you imagine a way, or do you already have a way to map these point changes to a high-level sort of principle that should hold throughout the entire configuration policy of the system? So I find the most implementable, highest impact change that I have to do, but the algorithm already does. An unprincipled administrator would say, hey, change it. Which might or might not necessarily reflect the high order sort of semantics that the system is supposed to maintain, the policy that the management comes down with. So do you have a way to map this to a high level policy, or is this level the level of policy that you're interested in this work?
So we do not have a way to map it into a higher level policy. We did not explore that with this work. We did actually find individual examples that suggested that would be a hard challenge to take on. In particular, instances where there might be, say, five instances of what seemed to all be a very similar pattern, and four of them were unacceptable, and the fifth one was needed, and you just needed to cope with the level of administrative privileges that was being granted there through some other way, say, having there be fewer incoming paths to get to that relatively dangerous set where after you've gotten it. So I have not worked on that problem, or we have not addressed that problem here. And I think that we may have interesting anecdotes in the paper to guide how that problem can best be addressed.
So I was wondering if you mentioned that your model, your heuristic for figuring out which cuts were ideal was based solely on a model based on number of incoming and outgoing edges. I was wondering if you've looked at any heuristics to try to take more information into account, both the type of a node and, more importantly, things like high-risk versus low-risk nodes. For instance, a node outside the firewall is at more risk, or a user that tends to roam and use a laptop on untrusted networks is more of a risk.
No, we haven't. I think that is a great idea for additional work, for future work.
Dave Hall, Harvard University. One of the basic premises or principles in securities is privilege. So have you looked at recommending when a user has too much access, recommending dividing their principle into the pieces, which Alice thought Rudy and Alice thought normal would not?
Mostly we did not look at that. In the organization that we studied, that is already done in a number of cases. So, for example, when somebody is a Kerberos administrator, they already have multiple accounts. And that's also done for a number of other known to be important administrative roles. However, even with that separation that already existed for well over 200 accounts, well over 200 high privilege administrator accounts, we still found that we had this problem. Okay. But it's certainly possible that that approach also could have been applied more, and that would have also helped with this problem.
Hi, Peter Cruz from Victor, Australia. Making these kind of configuration changes to essentially reduce the network of access can cause a lot of havoc in a system, breaking applications and workflows and stuff. Do you also support retroactively rejecting changes and learning from that?
So
after an administrator has accepted a change, realizing that's broken his network and actually having to retroactively reject that change.
So I want to say two things about that. So the first is that from the viewpoint of learning the model, we definitely support the administrator changing their mind about something that they told you earlier. The second thing is that we did not build mechanisms to go and automatically implement these changes, because that kind of software is already readily available. And so we didn't take that task on ourselves. We instead just have references in the paper to products that already go and implement these changes for you. The other thing, though, was that we were very sensitive to, actually, this is the third thing. The third thing is we were very sensitive to the fact that we might get things wrong. And that's why there's always this IT administrator in the loop of actually ever approving a security configuration change. What we're really trying to do is save them time so they don't have to wade through essentially millions of irrelevant changes.
Okay. Thank you, John.